Hey everybody, what's up? It is Saturday night, July 31st, 2010, Sound Off 119 here on SCScoops.com. I am the Solid Monster. Thank you so much, as always, for downloading the podcast. Going to do things a little bit differently this week, a little low on some news stuff, and then we're going to break into a Facebook mailbag. For those of you following the thread that I posted a couple of days ago on the official Facebook page, facebook.com/Solid Monster, I put a thread up there. We're going to do questions exclusively from that thread, at least this particular week, and we'll get to that in a second. Just want to comment on a couple of things first. Like I said, not a whole lot new going on from last week, and I wasn't able to really check out as much on TV as I wanted to this week. Had a lot going on, but I did manage to catch a good part of Impact this week. On Thursday night, which, by the way, Impact did pull in its biggest rating since February. It was just a little bit over a 1.2. I think that equals about 1.6 million viewers or so. So congratulations to Spike TV and Impact. The Motor City Machine Guns Beer Money Cage match on Thursday night, I just want to go out of my way to say, very good match. I enjoyed it a lot. Not surprising, considering the two teams involved. Of course, they've been engaged in a best-of series on Impact, and culminating in an Ultimate X match next week. So I'm sure that match will be just as good, if not better, than the matches they've had before. You don't really have too many great tag teams in wrestling these days. It kind of makes me sad that these two teams are not having these sort of matches in WWE, just because in WWE, I just think if they push tag teams a little bit better, you know, tag team wrestling overall would be better on a much grander scale. But, you know, WWE unfortunately doesn't have a whole hell of a lot of good tag teams, but TNA does. So I enjoyed the cage match on Thursday night. As for the rest of Impact, I really don't have anything to say. I'm going to try to be positive from here on out, and I will just go out of my way to say that the Machine Guns match on Thursday night was very good. You know, all the ECW stuff and Rob Terry killing Kazarian in 30 seconds and all that, whatever. I really don't have anything else to say about that show on Thursday. Raw Monday, I really don't have a lot to say about Raw either. The theme of the show is obvious. Building dissension within the ranks of Team Cena. Team Nexus, of course, who did wrestle on Monday night. Successful. John Cena's team coming apart at the seams, building a bit of intrigue, although the show overall was pretty predictable, actually, on Monday. That was pretty much Raw in a nutshell. Building towards SummerSlam. Now, they did tape two episodes of Raw Monday night. I actually have not yet read the spoilers for episode two. I just chose to stay away from them. I mean, if I stumble upon them, whatever. Not a big deal. I just have not checked out the spoilers yet. So the show this coming Monday night is a taped show. I believe there is a a match between Edge and Wade Barrett. And John Cena, I believe, has a battle with Chris Jericho, where the loser of that match will leave Team Raw for SummerSlam. We'll see if they follow through on that. So that's coming up on Monday night. But again, that was pretty much the main story they were building on Raw. Pretty predictable stuff. We still have a couple of weeks to go before the pay-per-view, but I like the build so far to SummerSlam. Of course, Kane and Rey Mysterio have their match for the World Heavyweight Championship. Sheamus defending the WWE title against Randy Orton, who I actually believe will be facing The Miz on Monday night. TNA, of course, has their Hardcore Justice pay-per-view coming up August 8th before SummerSlam. We have several names, actually, former ECW names that are confirmed for the show. Tommy Dreamer, of course, Nick Foley, Rob Van Dam, who is the reigning TNA champion. Team 3D, Raven, Rhino, Stevie Richards, Simon Diamond, Al Snow, Axel Rotten, and Johnny Swinger. A couple of names have actually turned down invites for the show. We know that Shane Douglas is one of those people. Steve Corino was never invited, but he's gone on record as saying he won't be there. I'm sure nobody really gives a shit. And I believe Lance Storm is the other name who, from what I understand the situation with Lance Storm, Lance Storm, for those of you who don't know, is a very vocal critic of TNA. It's hard not to be. But he, even more so than most. And he makes no bones about this. He has been very vocal about TNA and hasn't watched an episode of Impact. I think this past week was the first episode of Impact he's watched in well over 6 months. As the story goes, he received a text message from somebody believed to be Tommy Dreamer, more so as a courtesy, asking if he would want to participate in the pay-per-view. And before he can get any sort of monetary offer, he basically said, look, I appreciate the offer, but I'm not interested. As the story goes, it's probably to his benefit that he did not accept the invitation, because apparently he has a lot of heat amongst the TNA locker room. I don't know if this is true or not. This seems to be the big rumor going around this week. And had he agreed to show up in the Impact Zone for the show, bad things may have happened to Lance Storm. Now, this makes me laugh. You know, back in the 80s and the 70s, you know, the old days, this sort of thing probably was more commonplace than you would suspect in terms of, you know, locker room justice and that sort of thing. I just find the whole thing comical, because you cannot convince me that most of the talent in TNA, especially the younger homegrown talent who now are being overshadowed by the ECW guys and the Hulk Hogans and the Ric Flairs and the Stings, you can't tell me that these people don't actually, deep down inside, agree with Lance Storm about how shitty their overall product is. And it's not because of the in-ring product. I mean, just the creative direction of the company. I can almost guarantee, there's smart guys that work for that company. I can almost guarantee you most of them probably agree with his viewpoints. So the idea that Lance Storm would accept an invite to the pay-per-view, would show up and get beaten up or roughed up by the likes of Homicide and Samoa Joe and AJ Styles and people like that, just makes me laugh. I don't put much stock into that at all. It's kind of like the whole thing about gloves. You know, we've been poking fun at it on Facebook and stuff this week, the story about gloves being banned by WWE, because the genesis of that was a comment by Dolph Ziggler on Twitter. He used to wear gloves, now he doesn't. He claims that it's been banned. Nothing is always as it appears. When The Undertaker comes back, he'll be wearing his gloves. Rey Mysterio is still wearing his gloves. It's not a hard and fast rule. Maybe it only applies to the mid-card guys and not the main eventers, but to imply that nobody on the WWE roster is allowed to wear gloves is just incorrect. So I just wanted to clear that up as well. So anyway, Hardcore Justice coming up August 8th. We know Rob Van Dam will face Jerry Lynn in a reprise of their old great feud in the old ECW. That'll be your main event. And Raven goes one-on-one to rekindle his old feud with Tommy Dreamer. Mick Foley will be the special guest referee for that battle. And that's really all that's confirmed so far for the pay-per-view coming up. So TNA did make an announcement, the whole effing show. This is coming up on August 12th. Essentially what it is, it's a special edition of Impact, what would have been the original Hard Justice pay-per-view lineup before it got converted to an ECW reunion show. That will essentially be airing that night on Spike TV. There's a lot of matches, so they're going to have to cut a lot of them short, I think, to condense it into the traditional time. It's just a standard two-hour episode of Impact. I believe the main event is Rob Van Dam taking on Abyss in a ladder match with Janice above the ring. Every time I say Janice, I can't help but think of Tony Soprano's sister from The Sopranos. And all I can think of is it would be mighty difficult to hang that particular Janice from the ceiling. But I'm a bad person, I know. So that's your TNA news for the week. I'm going to be very nice to them this week, as you can tell. Another thing I want to mention here, I saw a bit of Chikara news for those of you who don't usually get your Chikara fill here on this podcast. I admit I don't talk too much about them, but Chikara made the announcement recently that they're going to be bringing in a very famous, world-renowned Japanese female wrestler for some shows they have coming up in Baltimore, Maryland, and New York in September. Now, the woman's name is Manami Toyota. And I really was not all that familiar with her work. Somebody had sent me a link via email to a match of hers back in her heyday, because she is a bit older than she was in her prime. Manami Toyota against Aja Kong, a name I remember growing up a WWE fan, because Aja Kong was brought in briefly into the World Wrestling Federation. This would have been around 1995 for a feud with the then women's champion Alundra Blaze. And I remember her being a beast in the ring, just one of these really stiff in-ring performers. And really, you could say that for a lot of the Japanese performers, both male and female. So anyway, send me a link to this two-part YouTube video, a match between Manami Toyota and Aja Kong from the Tokyo Dome in November 1994. I believe it was an All Japan Pro Wrestling event. And all I can tell you is, I'm a fan. of Manami Toyota after watching this match. It's just a phenomenal wrestling match. It's a little bit different. It's a different culture. You have the Japanese crowd. I think it just adds a lot to the match. But just a brutal, intense, great wrestling match that I really did not think I would get into as much as... And, you know, part of it is, again, we've been so desensitized to women's wrestling as we know it with the Divas and the Knockouts. Women's wrestling these days sucks. It's just not good. And that is, in part, the fault of the performers. You just do not have that many good female wrestlers, at least in the top two promotions in this country. I'm sorry. You just don't. And that's a shame. Plus, let's be honest here, at least in WWE more so, I think that this is a problem. The women just are not given a lot of time to shine. You know, the matches go literally 1 minute every week. Who could possibly care? When the company itself cares so little about women's wrestling. So watching a match like this was quite sobering. And I would suggest that all of you go on YouTube, find the video. Again, it's a two-parter, pretty good quality. Aja Kong, Manami Toyota, Tokyo Dome, November 94. Just a phenomenal match. And you will not regret spending 20 minutes of your time watching it. If you are a wrestling fan, you will enjoy it. So with that, we're going to break into the Facebook mailbag here. And I'll be doing this from time to time on Facebook or Twitter every now and then. I'll set up a week where I exclusively take questions from that particular forum as opposed to just the usual email questions, which still is the best way to reach me. I've lagged behind a little bit recently in part because of all the personal crap that was going on. It still is. But from time to time, there will be something like this. I think it's fun. I think it's just an easy way for people to post up questions and for me to just kind of run right through them one by one. Now, having said that, I just have to mention something here. I noticed a bunch of people posted questions on the Facebook page, on my wall, outside of the thread that I left, specifically for questions. Now, if these were just general questions being posted, fine. I'll get to them if I can. But it seemed that some people were posting questions on my wall that they had read I was doing a mailbag, and they were hoping that I would answer them on the air. If you did not leave a question in the thread that I specifically designed for this week's show, I will not answer the question on this podcast. I may answer it on my own on the Facebook page if I have time, but I specifically set that thread up for a reason. It just makes my life a lot easier when I run through these questions. And it won't clutter the wall up so much. It'll keep pretty much everything contained to that status thread. It doesn't matter how many comments are in there. I think there were something like 35 or 36 last time I checked. It could be 50. I will see them, and I will try to get to as many as possible. But if you're going to post things outside on the wall, I'm not going to answer it on the air. It has to be in the thread. So that in the future, when I do this, if you are sending in a question specifically for answer on the air, please, please, please put them in the thread. There's a reason I do it that way. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Now, that being said, let's break into some of these questions here. I actually have not had a chance to read through many of them, so this will be the first time I'm taking a look at them. So bear with me here. Get to as many as I can. Let's see here. Do you think Michael Cole listens to the Sound Off? And you praising him last week made him screw up his lines Monday night on Raw. Well, I admit that I had most of Raw on mute. I was just doing a lot of different things. And I was on the phone at one point. I really didn't hear any of the commentary at all Monday night, which probably made the show better for me. Of course, I'm sure Michael Cole listens to the Sound Off. In fact, I'm sure he listens to it in his headset during Raw, which may well be why he fucked up on Monday night. Or it could just be that he sucks. But I did praise him last week. That is true. I will give the devil his due when he deserves it. Michael Cole, I felt the week before when we first saw Team Cena go after the Nexus at the end of the show, I thought he did a very good job on commentary. And I won't say that very often, but when it stands out to me that he has a good performance, I will go out of my way to mention it. So that's why I did that. Would I like to see the return of the Attitude Era? No. What is my favorite Triple H match or moment? My favorite Triple H match would probably be a toss-up between the ladder match with him and The Rock at SummerSlam 98 and the street fight with him and Cactus Jack at the 2000 Royal Rumble. That was the match, incidentally, that I think really made his career and really cemented him as a bona fide, believable, credible main eventer. And it was a great fucking match on top of that. So it's kind of a toss-up. If I had to give the edge to one over the other, it would probably be that Royal Rumble street fight. Who was the bigger draw during their time, or their prime, rather? Hulk Hogan or Steve Austin? It's a difficult question to answer. Hogan was a draw on top for much, much longer than Austin was. For all intents and purposes, Austin really at his peak was only a top draw for about 2 years. Maybe 2.5, but really not much longer than that, in part because of the injury issues. But while he was on top, he did television ratings unlike Hogan ever did. He did merchandise sales certainly comparable to Hogan, if not better than Hogan. He did better pay-per-view buy rates than Hogan. The thing is, they're two totally different eras that you're comparing. You're comparing the 80s to the 90s. You're comparing the kiddie era of the late 80s, early 90s WWF to the Attitude Era and the Monday Night War era on cable TV of the WWF. So you can't really directly compare the two. Hogan was on top for longer. Austin probably drew more money and tickets, to be honest with you. Now, if you combine the two of them, if you could somehow mold the two of them together, you would have a super mega turbo draw on your hands. But to say that one was definitively the bigger draw over the other, you really could go either way on that. I mean, I might give the edge to Austin just for the time period that he was on top, but again, 2 years compared to what? 5, 6, 8 years as compared to Hogan. There's a big difference there. It's really hard to compare the two. Let's see here. Why are there no storylines anymore? It seems I don't know about that. It seems the Attitude Era, every feud has been wrestler A dislikes wrestler B. Where has the soap opera aspect / drama gone? Has it gone the same path as TV 14 programming? I don't know what you're talking about. Now, if you're suggesting that the, let's say, mid-card secondary storylines are not as good as they were 10 or 15 years ago, then yes, I agree. I will give Vince Russo credit for this. This is an amazing thing, by the way, the fact that I actually gave Michael Cole a thumbs up last week, and I'm going to give Vince Russo a thumbs up here. One of the things that Russo did back when he was in the WWF, not so much since he left, but when he was there and he was under Vince McMahon's watch, he went out of his way to make sure that most, if not all, of the mid-card and the lower-card guys had some sort of angle or storyline that they were involved in. If you think back to the Attitude Era, you had your top guys. You had Austin, you had Rock, you had Undertaker, Triple H, so on and so forth. And they were always locked in the championship hunt. But if you went a little further down the card, you had, let's say, The Godfather. You had The Road Dogg, Badass Billy Gunn, Val Venus, Al Snow, the 24/7 Hardcore Championship Rule. You had a lot of different things going on. And a lot of that was because of Russo. He went out of his way to do that. He wanted to push a lot of the younger guys. These days, I wouldn't say there's no mid-card storylines. I mean, look at the DiBiase-John Morrison thing. I mean, maybe it's not the best angle in the world, but still, it's a mid-card situation that WWE is pushing. But I agree. I mean, a lot of the attention and the focal points more often than not are on the main event guys, and I think it's at the expense of a lot of the lower card guys. I mean, does anybody really care about what feud Dolph Ziggler is in, for example? And it may not be Dolph's fault, but he just... I agree. It's not quite the same. You have a little bit of that, I guess, on SmackDown with Drew McIntyre and Teddy Long. That's not a main event feud, but it's certainly been going on for a while now, where Drew McIntyre and Matt Hardy. But yeah, I agree. I mean, these angles and storylines are not nearly as riveting as they could be back in the Attitude Era. Let's not look at things through rose-colored glasses here. There was plenty of garbage in the Attitude Era. Let us not forget Mark Henry and the Hand. You know, let us not forget... Katie Vick came a little just after the death of the Attitude Era, but still, things weren't always so great back then. So let's not heap all that praise on the Attitude Era. Let's see, another question here. How would I make some of the worst WWE gimmicks bankable? By eliminating them. If it's a bad gimmick, why bother? It's a lost cause. Too many gimmicks have killed too many careers. The Spirit Squad comes to mind, unfortunately. Eugene comes to mind. The Red Rooster comes to mind. If you know you have a bad gimmick, get rid of it. You're better off letting the guy just be himself, because if it's a bad gimmick, it's inherently bad. There's nothing you can do about it. Why would you keep pushing a bad gimmick if you know it's bad? It doesn't make any sense. Do I think the arena looked much better during the Attitude Era? That's a bit of an odd question, but an interesting one. I actually think it did, because it looks the same. That's why. If you really look at the setup of Monday Night Raw, for example, the only thing that's changed is the HD set. And even the HD set in and of itself, it's really just the LED lights where people walk out, where they can put the advertisements for the upcoming pay-per-view and such. You still have the big Titantron. You've got, you know, the basic... I mean, the ramp, I guess, they've kind of done away with, or they've made... It's not quite the same. But I watch Raw every week, and to me, it just looks bland. You know, the arena setup is almost identical to what it was 10, 12 years ago. I actually, believe it or not, I actually kind of like the old WCW Monday Nitro setup with the traditional long aisle way. And I mean, you could still keep the big Titantron, maybe make it a little smaller, put it in a different area. I'm begging them to do something different, because to me, it was better during the Attitude Era because it was fresh, it was new. I mean, I remember vividly when Gorilla Monsoon was the storyline interim acting, or rather just the storyline president of the WWF. This was in February of 1997, okay? The announcement was made that, I want to say it was March 6th. Let me go back here and take a look. Boy, if I'm right, this would be something if I'm right. Let's see here. Let's go back all the way in our time machine here, a.k.a. Windows calendar, to 1997, March. And it was not. It was March 10th. That's what it was. March 10th, 1997, was, I believe, the very first episode of Raw is War. That's when Raw was declared war. And we had the brand new setup with the big Titantron and the rampway. And pretty much since that time, the arena has not been any different. It's looked almost identical. And I think it's about time that they change that. Is it more of a Nitro setup? Do they come up with something completely unique and different? I don't know. But yeah, I agree. Back then it was fresh, but now, not so much. Maybe that's part of what makes Raw feel so bland sometimes. It just looks the same. Maybe that's part of it. I mean, believe me, it's the least of their problems. But I agree. I think the Attitude Era was... It was just a fresher look back then. Next question here. Why do you think people always bitch about John Cena having 5 moves, but they never bitch about anybody else who had a watered-down moveset and was champion all the time? For example, Bill Goldberg. Goldberg did a couple of kicks, some punches, a gorilla press slam, and then he would finish his opponent with the spear and the jackhammer. Back when I was growing up, I didn't hear one person bitching about Goldberg. Well, there's a reason for that. Goldberg is one of those guys where... Go back and watch some of the matches Goldberg had at his peak. The one that jumps into my head is where he won the... Not even where he won the world title from Hogan, which was the big one, but go back and watch the match he had on Nitro in 98 with Raven, when he beat Raven in a matter of minutes for the United States Championship. There's a point in that match, as I recall, where Raven goes into the ropes. He's beating on Goldberg. Goldberg's shaking it off. Raven hits the ropes, comes off, and Goldberg just absolutely obliterates him with a spear. The crowd, I cannot describe the crowd reaction when he hit that spear. The crowd was going apeshit for Goldberg, and the big difference is this. Goldberg does not come out, and I know exactly what the answer to this question is. Goldberg did not come out. Really, he didn't cut any promos, but he certainly did not cut these scripted, rehearsed, cutesy, hokey promos that John Cena cuts. I mean, when John Cena was coming out and battle rapping, and he was throwing out a bag of nuts, telling people to choke on these nuts, okay? People were not booing John Cena. I mean, when he was a heel, he got booed. But people actually enjoyed the battle rapping, edgier John Cena. It wasn't until he turned babyface and slowly but surely morphed into this disgusting TV PG figure that people started to resent him. That, and I think the jean shorts, too. Because let's be honest, who can really root for somebody who wears jean shorts into the ring? But in all seriousness, Goldberg did not come out and cut cutesy rehearsed promos. He came out, he did what he did best. He beat people up, he went back to the dressing room. That's what people liked about Goldberg. He had this explosive nature about him. There's nothing explosive about John Cena. Absolutely nothing. And I'm not saying he's a bad guy, but I'm saying that's why people, to this day, love to boo. I think it's become the cool thing at this point to boo him, but if you want to compare him and Goldberg, yeah, Goldberg didn't have a great repertoire, although Goldberg was pretty gifted athletically, especially early on in his WCW run. Goldberg had a knack for doing this standing backflip. I mean, he could just stand there and just do a backflip and land on his feet, which was pretty damn impressive. I don't think John Cena could even pull off something like that. But he didn't cut bullshit promos. He beat people up. 5 minutes, went back to the locker room. What's not to like about that? You know, what's not to like? All right, which would you kiss, marry, or kill out of the following group? Santina, Chyna, and Harvey Whippleman. Riveting questions here on Facebook, by the way. I think out of that group, I'd probably just kill myself, to be honest with you. I'd probably kill Chyna first, and then myself. Question from India here. Been listening since episode 111. This comes from Nitin Matthew. Why push small guys like Evan Bourne when there are enough big guys, from what I see, on NXT? So I see we have a Vince McMahon supporter here, somebody who actually does not agree with WWE going out of their way now to push some of the smaller guys. He thinks they should push the bigger guys. Well, I disagree with that. There's a lot of very talented smaller guys. In fact, I'll go out and say that there's more of the talented performers in the wrestling business today, not just WWE, are smaller than 6 feet tall. And at the end of the day, talent is what sells. Whether you're talented in the ring, if you're talented on the microphone, if you have the it factor, whatever the hell that is, you don't have to be 6'5" and 275 pounds to get over. And, you know, I mentioned on Impact earlier from this past Thursday, Rob Terry, for example, destroying Kazarian in a matter of seconds. What has Rob Terry ever done? You know, people say he's getting the Goldberg push. I just talked about Goldberg. Well, Goldberg had a certain explosiveness, and Goldberg was athletically gifted. And Goldberg was very good at coming out, beating people up, and leaving. Rob Terry is not even good at that. But yet TNA insists on pushing him. Okay, fine. WWE, I will give them credit. They still push big guys, but not just big guys. The Evan Bourne push, you know, it looks like it's cooled off. He's been beaten down a little bit over the last couple of weeks, but that's fine. Evan Bourne is certainly in the spotlight and highlighted more week to week on Raw than he was 6 months ago, for example. Will he ever be a world champion? Never say never. I don't see it happening anytime soon. But I do see WWE going out of the way. I mean, The Miz. The Miz is not a big guy. But WWE recognizes talent when they see it, and The Miz is on his way. The Miz will be a world champion sooner rather than later. And that's a good thing. You know, just because The Miz is not 6'3" does not mean he does not deserve the push that he's getting. I mean, that's just ridiculous. So I disagree wholeheartedly with that. I want WWE to push guys regardless of their size. If they happen to be a small guy and they're really good, push them. If you happen to have a guy that's 6'8", 300 pounds, if you have a Husky Harris, okay, if Eli Cottonwood was actually good and they pushed him, I would not be offended. The fact that Eli Cottonwood sucked a cock and got pushed, at least at the beginning of the season, I think he even had a victory over Cabal, I could be wrong about that, but is absolutely ridiculous. The guy was so green, and still is green. He'd blend in with my bushes, okay? I don't want to see people like that who don't have the talent, who don't know what the fuck they're doing, getting pushed down my throat on TV every week. Plus, I would imagine if you have a guy in there like that who's not very experienced, it's kind of dangerous to put other people in the ring with him. You know, Great Khali has not exactly come that far in the last 3 or 4 years he's been in WWE. But Khali is at a point where they don't have him do too much in there. He knows what he's capable of doing. They know what he's capable of doing. He has a role that he fills on the show. I will say that if I were in charge of WWE, Khali is probably one of those guys I would cut. I would have a cut list when I come in of guys I would get rid of. He would probably be on that list, just because I think he does not serve any further purpose. He's been with the company for a long time. He's been a heel. He's been a world champion. He's played the babyface role, which is usually death for somebody like that. He's done everything that could possibly be expected of him to do on TV. He has no, in my opinion, he's just taking up space on the roster. You know, he's a freak attraction, sure, but again, just because he's big, I don't think that means that people like that should be pushed. So I will disagree with that comment. Another question here, will John Cena ever go heel? Yes. The bigger question is when. Let's see here. If you were TNA, who out of the seven wrestlers whose non-competes recently expired would you hire? I am not quite sure what you mean by that question, although Consequences Creed, who was with TNA, was just signed by WWE, and he'll be heading to developmental. He probably would be one of those guys. I think that's a good pickup for the company, but I'm not too sure what you mean by the rest of the question. Who do I think could be in a dream match at next year's WrestleMania? I think I've mentioned before, Undertaker and Sting, I think, is a logical match. I'm guessing Sting's most recent deal is probably going to be up sometime between now and the end of the year. He's been having these one-year renewals the last couple of years. Is he going to go back to TNA? Who knows? I think it's a waste. They're not doing much with him. He's been world champ a couple of times. I think he's being overshadowed by Hogan and Flair and all those guys. If I'm Sting, again, time is running out. WrestleMania is in Atlanta next year. There's talk of them wanting to have a WCW-type theme to the Hall of Fame. It seems to me to be the perfect opportunity for Sting to bid farewell to TNA. He's given them a lot of service and a lot of time. Sign a contract, even just a short-term deal with WWE. They've shown their ability to do those sorts of things. In the past, WWE did not like signing people to short-term deals like that, but they did it with Bret Hart. I think they would do it with Sting. You know, sign him up. He'd probably get paid fairly well. Get a Hall of Fame induction out of it, probably a DVD, and get a WrestleMania payoff against The Undertaker. That's a match, I think, even now, with both guys not exactly in the best of physical shape, I think it's still a match people would pay money to see. Johnny wants to know, what really happened in 2005 with Matt Hardy, Lita, and Edge? Was it really a convincing storyline, or based on Lita cheating with Edge outside WWE in real life? It was a real-life situation that was converted into a storyline, and then the ball was subsequently dropped. Matt Hardy, you may recall, when he finally came back to WWE, because he had gotten fired, in real life, came back, and there was that one episode of Raw where he came back and had an open mic and cut a horrific promo. And that promo did him in. That promo single-handedly killed his career. But it was a real-life situation based in reality that was converted into a storyline. And as the story goes, basically Edge and Lita were fucking. Matt Hardy was unaware of this, discovered some text messages on Lita's phone one night, confronted her, threw her out of the house. You can watch, there's an episode of The Hardy Show on YouTube where Matt actually reenacts the whole thing. It's so comical. And just, again, it just shows you why Matt is in the position he's in right now. But it was entertaining, I will admit. But yes, it was a real-life situation that turned into an angle, and it turned out pretty damn well for Edge, not so much for Matt Hardy. Let's see here. Dear Solomonster, how many times during a WWE pay-per-view do you roll your eyes when you hear Michael Cole say something totally unnecessary or whatever Vince has just told him to say? For me, it's about 40 times and holding steady at the moment. Thanks. Well, me, I've lost count. Thankfully, I don't watch all the WWE pay-per-views, so my eyes aren't rolling in the back of my head probably as much as yours. But it's not just pay-per-views. It happens every week on Raw as well. So pretty much every week, my eyeballs roll around in my head a little bit. My ears bleed. You know, I have to stick cotton balls in there. You know, that sort of thing. What WWE stars would I make the main event for WrestleMania next year? I don't know. I mean, it would be kind of nice to see The Miz wait and cash in his Money in the Bank at WrestleMania next year against whoever the champion is. I think John Cena and The Miz could be a WrestleMania main event for the championship next year. If they don't blow their load too early on this whole thing. And it would be apropos because, again, you may recall last year, about a year ago, in fact, a little bit more, we had John Cena and The Miz. Everybody was stunned that they were putting The Miz in a feud with John Cena. And they were building it and building it and building it, and The Miz came out every week and claimed each week that John Cena ignored him would be a victory for The Miz. And he went 8-0 or something before Cena finally responded and crushed him. I mean, Cena just embarrassed him on pay-per-view. I believe it was The Bash. And The Miz even commented on this in a recent interview and said, look, I wasn't ready, but now I am. I think The Miz has come very far in the last 12 months, and I think were he now to be put up against Cena, it's still Super Cena. Let's be honest, Cena probably would still find a way to win, but I think people would look at that match, and a year ago they may not have paid money for it. Now I think they would. And if they build up The Miz the right way, and he holds on to that briefcase, and let's be honest, we know at some point the belt's going to be back on Cena. I could see that as a WrestleMania main event next year, and I actually would not mind that so much. Question here from Bobby. Given the recent Survivor Series match cards, or let's go back here. Given the recent Survivor Series match cards, i.e. random 4-on-4 matches, do you think that Survivor Series can continue to be a draw with pointless and meaningless matches? I hate to break it to you, but Survivor Series has not been a draw probably in a decade. In fact, the last good or great Survivor Series I could think of from top to bottom that I enjoyed anyway immensely was 2002 at Madison Square Garden. That was the very first Elimination Chamber match where Shawn Michaels won the world title. Brock Lesnar against Big Show for the WWE Championship, which was actually a great attraction. I remember vividly just Brock throwing Big Show around the ring and people just cheering like crazy. I mean, at one point he gave Big Show a German suplex, and then he gave him a belly-to-belly overhead suplex. And then he proceeded to pick him up on his shoulders for the F5, which just now doesn't seem as impressive, but back then it was just an amazing feat. And the crowd went nuts. Lesnar was way over that night. Still undefeated, so of course they had Big Show beat him. But still, I really enjoyed that pay-per-view. And Survivor Series just isn't a draw anymore. I'm happy to see that it got saved. And I'm still waiting for them to come to their senses and give us a War Games match at Survivor Series. But I think that would be a draw. As it is now, Survivor Series just does not draw any money. It just doesn't. I mean, that concept is just, in part because they've made it that way, but the concept just does not sell pay-per-views anymore. And that's unfortunate. All right, next question here. Who has been financing TNA because they are wasting all their money on all of these ex-WWE superstars? I just don't believe that Dixie Carter will actually spend her own money to fund TNA, so my question is it only Dixie Carter funding it or some sort of corporate business? Dixie Carter is not funding TNA. Let's clear that up right now. Her father, Bob Carter, and Panda Energy, they are funding TNA. Dixie Carter is not funding TNA. She is the president of TNA. TNA is her pet project. It's her baby. But she is not pumping her own money into it. And you have to question how much longer Panda Energy and Bob Carter is going to want to keep pumping money into TNA unless they can figure out a way to make money. I've been a listener since Sound Off 46, and I love it. I was wondering where I could find the first 50 Sound Offs. I have them all, but I just don't know exactly where or how I'd be able to get them up. I have very limited bandwidth space on Podbean, which is where I upload the podcast to every week, and I actually pay a nominal fee for this volunteer podcast. But anyway, I just don't have the space on Podbean for it. And I'm not going to pay extra money to post, you know, the first 50 episodes that I did. So if someone out there has a solution, I'm more than willing to hear you out. And maybe I'll upload. Every now and then I will post a vintage sound off. You just have to pay attention on Facebook and Twitter every now and then. Especially if there's a week where I know I'm not going to be able to do a new show. I posted, you know, episode 17, episode 30. I think I did episode 75 with the infamous Michael Jackson rant. I posted that several weeks ago, so that one's still up, actually, if you go back and check. But I've got them all, but unfortunately I can only keep the last 20 or so episodes up active on the server. But if there is another solution that somebody's aware of, email me and let me know. and if there's even an interest. I mean, if the interest isn't that widespread, I wouldn't want to do it, but if there's enough of an interest, maybe I will. Sarah wants to know, who do I think the next three big stars of WWE will be and why? If you're talking about current stars who aren't quite there yet but are almost there, I mean, The Miz would be at the top of my list, but if you're look at the NXT guys, for example. Let's look at the NXT Season 1 rookies. I love the way that they push these guys. You know, when the whole NXT angle first started, I could name a couple of those guys, but not all of them, off the top of my head. Now, it's second nature. Everybody knows who Heath Slater is. Everybody knows who Michael Tarver is. Everybody knows who Wade Barrett is, obviously. Of those guys, Wade Barrett, he's going to be a big deal. I mean, he'll be a world champion. He's very good on the mic, very poised. He can only get better in the ring. So Barrett would be certainly at the top of anyone's list. I happen to think there's something about Skip Sheffield. His appearance, his explosiveness, there's that word again, that makes me think he's going to be a big breakout star at some point. Maybe even as a babyface and not so much as a heel. So I would keep my eye on Skip Sheffield. Heath Slater as well, I think. There's something with him, Justin Gabriel. There's a lot of talented guys in that group. I'm not a fan of David Otunga, other than the fact he has personality, he's got mic skills, he has no ring skills at all. He has not gotten any better. Tarver, maybe. But, you know, Tarver, again, doesn't impress me as much as the other guys. Now, from what I've seen of the Season 2 NXT rookies, Michael McGillicuddy, he's got the pedigree. He's obviously still very green, but I think there could be something there. Caval has the most experience. I mean, of all the guys in the current NXT season, I mean, Caval has 12 years of wrestling experience. So he's head and shoulders above everybody else. It doesn't mean he's going to win the competition. I don't expect him to, but Caval certainly is... he has his size working against him, but I still think he could be a star. Husky Harris, a lot of people very impressed with Husky Harris, myself included. Alex Riley reminds me of a younger Miz. It's hard to predict who the next three big stars are going to be. It all depends on who they push and who catches fire with the crowd. But all those names I mentioned, I think, Barrett, Sheffield, Caval, and I do think Husky Harris actually is going to be a big deal as well. How big, I don't know, but those are the guys that stand out to me more so than others. Let's see. Dav wants to know, whose Slurpee straw am I most looking forward to sucking on? Ah, you bastard, I see what you did there. Very funny. Why won't Vince McMahon make Hornswoggle the leader of Nexus? It would be perfect. Him being treated as a joke and disrespected fits right in with why Nexus claimed they attacked everyone at first. Hornswoggle could come out and cut a promo about him not being a leprechaun and living under the ring, etc. I gotta be honest with you, it wouldn't be the worst idea in the world. It really wouldn't. I mean, would it be ridiculous? Of course. But I would love to see Hornswoggle just come out one day and speak like a normal person. We all know he can. He could be a manager. He could be a mouthpiece. And it could actually draw. I really think it could draw if they play their cards right, because who wouldn't want to see the midget get his ass kicked? Who wouldn't want to see a good old-fashioned midget toss? He could be like an old-school Bobby Heenan, who always got his butt kicked by Hulk Hogan. People paid money. They hated Bobby Heenan so much. They wanted to see him get beat up. And if you push Hornswoggle the right way, and if you can cut a good enough promo on the stick, you could potentially make money off that. I read that at first. I thought he was joking. I don't think Corey was joking, and I don't think it's such a horrible idea. I could think of worse people who could be revealed in the end to be the benefactor of Nexus. Hornswoggle is not the worst option. David from Sydney, Australia here with a post. I've been listening since episode 97. It helps me get through Monday work in my cubicle. I noticed in your Facebook profile, Solomostu, you have read The Death of WCW. Is there any other wrestling books that you have read and liked that were not released by WWE? A favorite of mine is Between the Ropes. I have not read that. I would suggest the Chris Jericho book, A Lion's Tale, his first book. He has a second one coming out. That book was done... I don't believe that book was released under the WWE banner. I believe that was done independently, as was Bret Hart's book. It's a long book, but Bret Hart's is probably one of the, if not the best wrestling book out there. If you have not read it, definitely check out those two books. Kyle from Bossier City here. Been listening since Sound Off 54. I read on SC Scoops that John Morrison is thought of as potentially being the next Shawn Michaels. Even Jim Ross commented on this on his one of his recent blogs. Personally, I don't think anyone ever will live up to the legacy of HBK, but I do really like Morrison. What do you think about this? I think John Morrison should go out there and be the best John Morrison he can be. If you're going to be compared to somebody like Shawn Michaels, it's like Ric Flair. You know, Ric Flair is getting into the business. He's the son of the Nature Boy. But unfortunately for him, he will forever be compared to his father. And those are just impossible shoes to fill. You don't want to be the son, for example, of somebody famous, of somebody who was one of the all-time greats. Because it's very rare that you can live up to that sort of legacy or step out of that shadow. I think John Morrison should go out there and just be the best John Morrison he can be. You know, if people want to compare him to Shawn Michaels, it's a phenomenal compliment to be paid. But those are also very big shoes to fill. There will never be another Shawn Michaels. There will never be another Shawn Michaels. And there shouldn't be. I think Morrison is one of the more gifted athletes, now that Shelton Benjamin no longer is on the roster, one of the more gifted natural athletes that they have. But he was also a gymnast, I believe. So that's why he can be so flexible. That's why he can do some pretty amazing things with his body in that ring. But he that's the advantage that he has. I personally think he's a much better heel than a babyface. A heel turn wouldn't be the worst thing in the world for him, but just let him go out there and be himself, and he'll be fine. And let's see here. What is my favorite and least favorite Survivor Series elimination tag matches? Favorite? Honestly, I mean, I had a lot of matches that I enjoyed from those early, Survivor Series shows, the ones from the early 90s and such. My favorite one, honestly, probably would be the wild card match from the 1995 Survivor Series. And there wasn't much to love about WWF in 1995, or really wrestling in general. But back then, it was an intriguing concept. I mean, now I don't think people would bat too much of an eyelash. But back then, the concept of Gorilla Monsoon putting this match together, where baby faces and heels are just kind of randomly mixed up and have to work together as partners, was a very intriguing concept. You know, on one team you had, I believe it was Owen Hart, Yokozuna, Razor Ramon, maybe, and Shane Douglas against Shawn Michaels, Psycho Sid, Ahmed Johnson, and maybe the British Bulldog. Of course, people turned on each other and such, and in the end, Shawn and Ahmed were victorious. But I love the concept of that match, and I always wished that they were... I always hoped they would make that maybe like an annual thing, and they didn't. That was the only time we ever saw it. It's kind of like the 92 Royal Rumble, where it was the only Rumble to this day where the championship was vacant and it was up for grabs. And I can't really think of why they haven't done that since. But, the wild card is probably my favorite, certainly one of my favorites. My least favorite probably was the one from 94, I want to say, with Doink and Dink and Pink and Wink and Link and whatever the fuck their names were. Doink and the Midgets against Jerry Lawler and his Midgets, Queasy, Sleazy, Beasley, whatever the fuck. Again, it's just such a stupid match. Lawler was involved in a lot of stupid stuff back then, the Kiss My Foot crap with Bret Hart and all that, but that was probably my least favorite Survivor Series match. Actually, another match that wasn't my favorite, but it wasn't really all that bad, was the Survivor Series elimination match from 2003, which was the one where Shawn Michaels was the last one in there and got beat ultimately. He got pinned by Randy Orton. He did the blade job, and Shawn Michaels does such a good job of playing the babyface in peril. And you may recall that it was Team Austin against Team Bischoff. And so as the rules went, if Steve Austin's team did not win, Austin would have to leave. He would have to retire or be gone from WWE. And Shawn did his best to try to hang in there, but ultimately he got beat and Austin had to leave. And it was just great drama, I remember, during that match. So that was another good one. And the last question here from this mailbag here on Facebook comes from David George. Solomonster, do you think there is room in WWE's future to have new characters with supernatural gimmicks like The Undertaker and Kane, or will we continue to see a shift to more realistic storylines? It seems like over the past couple of years, we've seen more wrestlers using their own stereotype as a gimmick as opposed to having a fictional pre-WWE storyline. So I was curious what you thought on the subject. I think we will always see shitty gimmicks in WWE. hopefully less of them. But supernatural powers, probably not so much. Probably not so much. I mean, you name the, you know, David named The Undertaker and Kane, and I can't think of too many others that had supernatural powers. I don't know what the fuck Max Moon was supposed to be, but he certainly, I mean, he shot fireworks out of his arms. I wouldn't call that supernatural necessarily. But, you know, aside from Kane and Undertaker, you really won't find gimmicks from over the years with supernatural powers. It was always just shitty gimmicks. I mean, T.L. Hopper, the plumber, the goon. I was going to say Waylon Mercy, but, you know, I got to say Waylon Mercy was actually a fucking genius gimmick. 1995, I keep going back to this. This was one of the worst years to be a WWF fan. You had so many crappy gimmicks. I mean, you had Tracy Smothers and the Freddie Joe Floyd gimmick. You had T.L. Hopper, who was a dirty white boy, basically, from Smoky Mountain, playing a plumber with his plunger, Old Betsy. You had the goon, played by, I think, Bill Irwin, who, of course, was a hockey player, or an ex-hockey player, who wore these boots that were supposed to look like skates in the ring. And Alex the Pug Porteau, Duke the Dumpster Drosy, the Garbage Man, Isaac Yankum, DDS, of course, one of the worst of them all. You know, Mantar, who I guess was supposed to be half man, half tar, I suppose. You had Santa Claus, who, of course, was supposed to be the opposite of Santa Claus. Ha-ha. Yeah, but Waylon Mercy was played by Danny Spivey, who is a famous wrestler. And unfortunately, by this point, 95, Spivey was already physically breaking down. He had a match at a WWF Superstars taping where he fought the WWF champion, Big Daddy Cool Diesel. I believe it was it might have been a non-title match, or maybe it was a title match, but in any event, the angle at the time was that the champion, Diesel, was on a bit of a losing streak. And it continued. I believe the British Bulldog, who he was feuding with at the time, came out to distract, and he ran into the aisleway and was fighting with the Bulldog, and then he got counted out. And Waylon Mercy won the match. Diesel came back in the ring in a fit of rage and gave him a big boot and a powerbomb. And that powerbomb really fucked up Spivey's back and ultimately led to his retirement. So a Kevin Nash powerbomb ended the career of poor Waylon Mercy. You could find the match on YouTube. I just watched it actually the other day. But Waylon Mercy was a great gimmick. It was clearly based off, I believe, the De Niro character in Cape Fear. And he just had that creepy entrance music. He goes like, lives are gonna be in Waylon Mercy's hands. And then, you know, it would go into this piano theme or something, and just creepy, creepy shit. But it was a great gimmick, and it just never really had an opportunity to take off, and physically he just couldn't do it anymore. That might have been one of the few good things to come out of WWF that year. You know, but as far as a shift towards more realistic characters, I think it's the way to go. UFC, if nothing else, has proven that people want to see more of an athletic competition, and there will always be room for funny characters and things like that in pro wrestling. I don't want pro wrestling just to become what UFC is, but there are lessons to be learned. And if you go back to the Attitude Era, Steve Austin was not some shitty, crappy gimmick. He was Steve Austin with the nickname Stone Cold. He got over pretty well. You know, The Rock was not a gimmick. He was just a name, but he was essentially himself, Triple H. Didn't come out with, you know, ridiculous props and a mask or some stupid shit like that. These guys were allowed to be themselves. Kurt Angle, Chris Benoit, Chris Jericho. So they're real names. Well, not with Chris Jericho, but there's nothing wrong with that. And I think we should have a bigger shift towards that, because it's 2010, people. It's not 1995. You know, we need to see more of that. We need to see more reality, I think, infused into these shows. The Nexus angle, that very first night when they came out and they just destroyed the ringside area and they beat up John Cena. You know why that worked? Because people thought it was real. It felt real. It felt unpredictable. It didn't feel like a wrestling angle. You know, a wrestling plumber and a wrestling dentist and a wrestling tax auditor. God bless IRS, but That's not what we need to see. That's not what we need to see. So anyway, that's going to wrap up the Facebook mailbag. Again, I'm limiting myself to questions that were posted in the thread as I originally asked, so I thank all of you for that. In the future, please, please, please post in the thread. And I'll try to get to the other questions on Facebook or directly via email if I can. You can email questions, comments, suggestions, and the like to thesolomonster at gmail.com, twitter.com/solomonster. You can follow me on there. Friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/thesolomonster. I might be putting some new pictures up there soon. Try to spruce up the Facebook. So you got to friend me to get on there, so do that. And you can download the podcast for free, as always, in the iTunes store. Look it up on there, and it'll make your life a lot easier when you're listening to the podcast. So I was excited to see that the Tim Arson, the better known as the ECW Zombie, is now a friend of mine on Facebook. I love the Zombie, by the way. That's the only thing I think that the ECW thing on TNA is missing. It needs more Zombie. Maybe we'll try to get the Zombie on for an interview one of these days. But anyway, until next time, episode 120 coming up next week. Be well, stay safe. Thanks, as always, for listening to the show. Because without you, there is no sound off. Well, there is a sound off, but it doesn't really help me if nobody listens to it. So thanks, as always. We'll be right back here next week. Take it easy, guys.
You've been listening to The Solomonster.
You know, I really just don't understand what they're doing.
Anybody agree with me out there?
I mean, anybody. Come on, throw me a bone here.
Probably the single dumbest thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
God, I love this business.
On SEScoops.com.